This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 6th of March 2012 on Monocle 24.
Guten Abend and welcome to Midori House live from Berlin on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. We have an action-packed show from the German capital today. In a moment, we'll be joined in the studio by Ulf Poschardt, Deputy Editor-in-Chief of Die Welt newspaper, to discuss how the world sees Germany and how Germany wants to be seen. We'll also be talking about fine papers and beautiful binding with Robert Klanten, President of Architecture and Design Publishing firm Gestalten, about their media model and Berlin as a base for publishing. And we're going to be talking to the designers and founders of Mykita, the Berlin-based eyewear company, to ask about Berlin as a hub for running a business. All that, plus a few tales from our man in the city, Marcus Albers, and some entertaining tips from a leading entrepreneur and restaurateur, right here on Midori House, live from Berlin, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, which has temporarily become Funkhaus, as we're coming to you live from Funk Studios in the Kreuzberg district of Berlin. And joining me to kick things off today are my colleagues, Santiago Tartiti and Nelly Gocheva. Welcome.
Hey, Tyler, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you? What have you been up to today? Nelly, you first?
Well, we visited this amazing store, Andreas Mercuris. It's a great, great shop.
They've relocated.
Yeah, yes. They did relocate, like, I think in July last year. Yeah. But it's an amazing facility. It's a former printing facility, newspaper printing facility. It's a great place with amazing brands.
Any purchases yet?
Not yet. Okay. Hopefully tomorrow.
Maybe
later.
And you were tagging along, Santiago?
Yeah, I was there. And then I convinced Nelly to go and have lunch at the Café Einstein.
Right.
You've been there before,
you right? Schnitzeled out now?
Yeah.
She did,
Kleine
yeah.
Portion. It was really
you
big, though.
You had Kinder Schnitzel.
It was good, yeah. I had the salad, the house salad, and then a bit of club sandwich.
Right. Now, aside from the fact that we're here, we're having a reader's event, the principal mission for both of you is...
We're going to the ITB tomorrow. It kicks off tomorrow and it runs up until the 11th. So hopefully we'll meet interesting people and brands there.
My mission for now is being a polysol and smiling and drinking and meeting people.
Right, which should be good. And then also you have another bar lined up for us tonight. There's an opening, but we can save that for tomorrow for people to have a listen to then. Your big challenge for both of you tomorrow when you go to ITB, and I'm always amazed because are you both ITB virgins? I'm not sure.
I am.
I am too.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. So when you go, it is incredible because it is something like Epcot Center, but for adults, for people in the travel industry, because you're just amazed by the pavilions that all of these countries, regions, cities, resorts build. And I think one of the best things we did with Andrew, I think it was probably 2 years ago, and Andrews, we were on one of the Indian pavilions, they're of course trying to you know feature their Bengal tigers. So we came back with the best photograph. It wasn't a real Bengal tiger; it was a stuffed one.
So it feels like
which made it even better.
It feels like it's small world ride in.
Yes, exactly. So I think both of you. Well, I'm going to be doing tomorrow morning's program. I'm going to be checking in with the Globalist. Nelly, you're going to be on the program briefing later on, and probably Santiago before your wheels up, you'll be on another program.
Ready for the check-ins.
All right. Well, look forward to seeing both of you later on this evening.
Absolutely.
It's now time to go back over to London for the news with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Mitt Romney could take a big step toward polishing off chief rival Rick Santorum and seize command of the race for the Republican US presidential nomination today, with Ohio the biggest prize among 10 states holding contests. Romney, the winner of the last 5 state contests, carried momentum into Super Tuesday today. Polls show he's effectively erased Santorum's lead in Ohio, a traditional bellwether state that could play an important role in deciding the Republican nominee to challenge President Barack Obama on November the 6th. But Santorum vowed to keep fighting, hoping to rally conservatives who still harbor doubts about Romney's chances of beating Obama.
Just focus in on whether we want a man who can stand up and paint a very different vision for this country. Someone who's got a principled record, someone who's willing to go out and talk about all the issues that are confronting this country, not just how we're going to manage the economy better.
The Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, faced growing Western anger today for preventing aid from entering a devastated district of Homs and over accusations of human rights abuses, including pictures which said to show torture victims at a hospital in the city. Dozens of men, women and children returned on foot to Babur Amr, passing bullet-pocked and damaged buildings days after rebel fighters pulled out after a sustained and heavy military assault. The Red Cross was awaiting approval to distribute aid to the devastated district, which endured a month of siege. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton has written to Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, accepting an offer to meet to discuss Tehran's nuclear program. Ashton represents six powers, the United States, Russia, China, France, Britain and Germany, in dealings with Iran. And her offer of talks came after weeks of consultations with them. She said the date had yet to be decided.
We hope that we will be able to now pursue with Iran constructive engagement with the purpose of addressing the international community's concerns about the nuclear program. We will, in the course of the next few days, decide the dates and the venue.
Civic leaders in Libya's eastern region of Cyrenaica have declared the creation of an autonomous council. About 3,000 delegates in the city of Benghazi installed Ahmed al-Sanusi, a relative of Libya's former king and a political prisoner under Colonel Gaddafi as head of the new council. The region is home to most of Libya's oil resources. Speaking on the briefing on Monocle 24, Firas Abi Ali from the think tank Exclusive Analysis said that the imbalance in oil wealth was a major factor in creating the council.
What we are seeing is basically a regional division that follows from the imbalance between the distribution of the population and the distribution of the oil. Around two-thirds of Libya's oil production is conducted in eastern Libya.
Flooding across the three states in eastern Australia have left large swathes of farmland underwater, numerous small towns inundated with water and forced a total of 10,000 people from their homes. In the town of Wagga Wagga, 450 kilometres southwest of Sydney, 8,000 residents were given an order to evacuate late last night and are now waiting to see if the Murrumbidgee River breaks a levee protecting the town centre. Writer Jack Marks spoke to Monocle 24 from Wagga Wagga and says that there could be worse weather to come.
A few hours ago, the severe weather warning for the coast, for the Hunter and Illawarra region. Now that's probably going to come inland as well. So the reports that everything's fine are probably a little premature.
And US authorities have said that top members of the Lulzsec computer hacking group have been arrested, and its leader had previously pleaded guilty to carrying out over a dozen cyber attacks on major companies. Hector Xavier Monsegur, known as Sabu, was charged with 12 criminal counts of conspiracy to engage in computer hacking and other crimes. In court documents made public today, he admits to hacks on the websites of eBay, PayPal, MasterCard and Visa. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you, and Dankeschön, Mr. Kelly. It's now time to see what Mr. Schaffernecker has in store for us. Beautiful day here in Berlin. Let's see what it's like across the rest of the world.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Europe, and in the next 24 to 48 hours, wind and rain for the UK, France and Germany. Meanwhile, in Poland and countries further east, winter has essentially returned with sub-zero daytime temperatures. And the Mediterranean will have poorer weather too, particularly in Italy and Greece. So in summary, the midweek weather across Europe is not especially appetising. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. In London, 11 degrees and rain. Paris, 8 Celsius, also rain. Berlin, 8 degrees, a bit of sunshine here. But in Moscow, it's minus 7 degrees, cold and cloudy. North America now, the weather is looking good across the eastern seaboard. If you're heading off to JFK or Dulles Airport, expect mild and bright weather on arrival over the next couple of days. And even in Canada, it'll warm up as far north as Montreal. End of the week, however, central US, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, potentially looking stormy again. Wednesday's city outlook, Montreal 9 degrees and some sunshine. In Chicago, a very mild 15, partly cloudy. New York City 14 and sunny. San Francisco 17 degrees with sunshine as well. Let's have a look at the southern hemisphere now. In Rio, typical late summer weather, 27 degrees with sun and scattered showers. In Cape Town, the next 2 days, hot and sunny, highs of around 30 degrees. And if you're in Sydney, cooling off midweek, only 22 with heavy showers, but some sunshine too. And other than that, a lot of flooding still in New South Wales from the recent rainstorms of last week. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernecker here on Monocle 24.
And that was Thomas Schaffernecker with the world weather. You're listening to Midori House. We're live in Berlin. We're back right after this.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 Tagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e io cosa?
Tama on Monocle 24.
The Broca Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are back with Midori House live from studio, well, I don't know, it's maybe Studio Drei or Studio Vier here at Funkhaus in Berlin. It's just coming up to 1910 here in Berlin. It's 1810 in London. Well, since 2008 and the global economic crisis, Germany has positioned itself, well, rather well. Its budget is on track, unemployment is shrinking, and Angela Merkel continues to put Germany first, indirectly insisting that to succeed, Europe has to become more German. Germany is in the lead in Europe, but does the country acknowledge it? And how likely is it to change in the coming months? Well, joining me now in studio is a very dear old friend from the world of media, German media, Ulf Poschardt. He's also the deputy editor-in-chief of the German Daily Die Welt. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
To start, we can address Germany in a second, but you are a hugely respected editor in this country. The state of German media, we talk about it a lot at Monocle, and it's a fascinating model because in the Anglo-Saxon world, we become so consumed with what the Americans are doing and are in our own little world in London sometimes, and rarely do we look across the channel at what's happening here. I'm wondering if, is it German conservatism that allows newspapers to still sell copies, that DVDs are still selling in this country, that people are even buying CDs, heaven forbid. What's the media mood of?
Well, it's a very interesting situation because I think in every media house, people are talking about the changes. And if we look what happened to the New York Times and other very famous media, and you analyze the global crisis of print media, the first reaction was you go into worst case scenarios. And you look at all your numbers, and then you get the feeling that the end is near, and stop doing newspapers, invest everything in online business. And I think this phase is kind of over. I mean, we had those discussions, I think, 5 or 6 years ago, and then we realized that the print sales are quite stable. And on the other hand, we realized that you can make money online. So I think the panic reactions are going down, and I think we are doing it in a very old-fashioned German way. We are looking at it without angst and try to figure out what's the best concept for media houses like Axel Springer, where we said 8 years ago, online first, and kind of developed our tiny little online thing, Welt.de, into now the third biggest brand in news. And on the other hand, we decided to invest a lot of print or a lot of investments in print, especially on weekends, because we realized that the Sunday market is a growing market. Now we will invest in the Saturday market. So we believe in print and we believe in online. And what you mentioned, that the German conservatism may be helpful. I think that's true. I think we are not like the early adopters. We're kind of the late adopters, but then try to make it as best as possible.
Mm. Is it conservatism or is it also a healthy dose of German skepticism as well, which has contributed to this?
I think this always comes together. I think conservatism without skepticism, that's not imaginable. I think the skepticism is. I mean, you know Germany very well, so you know that there's always this kind of anti-American feeling. Say we don't want to become that Western as America or as the Anglo-Saxon capitalism. We always want to do our own thing, like the Rheinischer Kapitalismus, which is kind of a social form of capitalism. So I think this is quite good. And if we are talking about media, I think also the quality of our media is pretty good. I mean, I worked for Condé Nast and I had the pleasure of spending a month in New York and working with the editors there at the Condé Nast building, fantastic editors, and they all had a very I think I realized that the German media have a very good reputation there, from Stern, Spiegel, the newspapers. I think it's good.
It's curious when you look at the German market, though, because in many ways it's quite evolved. And you mention, I mean, for example, Der Spiegel, that here you have a print brand, but it's also incredibly strong in television and documentaries. Mm-hmm. And that's actually, it's quite unique, because you can't look to the United States and say, okay, there's a 60 Minutes magazine, and then there's also the 60 Minute TV franchise. And do you think that's also part of it? And in a curious way, how so many of the German print brands also require, and it even predates, all things digital. They were already strong in electronic media in a way.
Right. That's true. I think the Spiegel is a very interesting example, because it has to do with the person who was running the Spiegel, Stefan Aust. I mean, he started being a fantastic writer in the 70s, really left-wing. And then in the late 80s, he realized that maybe doing political television, maybe something which is interesting for him, and he did a fantastic job there. And he was one of the founders of Spiegel TV. And because of the quality of this TV format, the people who run the Spiegel, the magazine, ask him to be the editor of the magazine. So that was kind of, we are early adopters then by picking somebody from a TV format to make him editor of the most important print printed magazine in Germany.
You clearly meet your consumers, and I wonder, when you look at really the man and woman on the street in this country, is there a different level of respect for journalism that maybe you don't feel? You've spent a lot of time in New York, but I think when you look at other countries around the world, because I'm wondering the passion that still exists for the printed word, that the news weeklies in this country still do well. I imagine that there'll be probably other print editions that come from Die Welt at some point. Why is that? What is the culture, do you think, in Germany, that there's this, this real love of paper?
I think it's the tradition. If you know the German saying, it's the country of the Dichter und Denker saying, it's the country of the authors and philosophers. Because of that, we have a cultural tradition of reading books and newspapers and magazine. On the other hand, I would be quite happy if the reputation of journalists in Germany is as good as you mentioned it. I think the Germans like media, but don't like journalists. And I think it's a very good thing. Because they really want to know what you're writing. They want to know everything about your opinion, about your research and everything. But at the end, they want to make up their mind by themselves. So they're hating those persons who push them in one direction. But they still buy you. So whenever I write a light article, that's meaning a big op-ed, and I got like hundreds of emails and letters, and 80% are negative, but still they write at the end, it's a pleasure reading this. And I think that's a very interesting approach to journalism, and a very good one, because you can't sell them bullshit.
This is true. When you sit on the editorial floor and you look at the power that this country has, certainly within the European sphere, but still internationally as well, is there a certain, I wouldn't call it crisis of confidence, but how far German journalists push themselves? Because, here you are half century later, the top dog on this continent again. And I'm wondering how that manifests itself on the editorial floor.
Very modestly. I think because of our history, we are not able to talk about this as straight as I think it's needed to be done. I think the Germans right now, they love the idea that they are the hidden champions in Europe. I think Angela Merkel as a chancellor, she's the person who is like very silent and very modest about the power Germany has now. And I think it's very important for us to play that role. Otherwise, I think all the things Angela Merkel now implanted in the EU would be impossible if the strong Germany and a muscly talking Germany is is threatening our neighbors. So I think it's a very good position. On the other hand, I think it's kind of disappointing that especially the intellectuals in Germany don't want to talk about this. I mean, being number one doesn't mean that you have to like raise the German flag and sing national anthem. I think it's all about the responsibility and the challenge to make a modern Europe interesting and liberal and modern by being inspiring as Germans and with our industries, with our education, and maybe also with our media. But this whole discussion, it's not happening in Germany.
Mm. So, yeah, if you're an editor in chief and some copy comes across your desk that you feel that they go a step beyond modesty, do you feel morally bound as an editor to also round it out, or are you really an advocate to say, look, maybe this should go through, and if we get a mailbag of letters, so be it.
We always, I mean, if you buy the Welt or Welt am Sonntag, we always do that. I think we are trying to have this discussion in our newspapers, and our readers want that, and we have like amazing commentaries from our readers, but I think we have to do it. And we had an interesting discussion with Henry Kissinger and Lord Weidenfeld 2 years ago. And whenever Henry Kissinger comes to Berlin, we invite like young leaders, politicians, artists, writers. And Lord Weidenfeld said, Germany has to realize it's now number one in Europe and it has to lead. And Henry Kissinger said, both like Jews who survived the Holocaust, I can't say that, but maybe it's true. And then I asked into this panel of people there and said, do we want to talk about this? And it was silence. Mm. Nobody did.
Ulf Poschardt, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. Ulf Poschardt, Deputy Editor-in-Chief of Die Welt here in Berlin. You're listening to Midori House. We are live right here on Monocle 24. We're back right after this.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about making things better. Each week, I'll take you on a rollicking romp through the worlds of design, craft, architecture, fashion, and graphics, with factory frolics, building tours, product tests, and studio guests.
They're beautiful, they're functional. When you use them, they are completely poetic. They lift that activity, whatever it is, to another level. It makes you aware of the quality of what you're doing.
Tune in every week to hear the stories behind the things that we live with. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
And you are back with Midori House, our contributing editor, Marcus Albers, who until now has been our correspondent. I'm not sure if you're moving upstairs or if it's a lateral move, but you're contributing editor, and Kimberly Bradley is going to be taking over the hat. Welcome.
Thanks. Hello.
I wanted to maybe kick off by just talking about the state of the city, and hopefully it won't happen this evening, but I've often maintained that every time I come to Berlin, I always have the sense that I'm never at the right party, which fills me with this incredible angst when I'm here, because there is so much going on. there are so many pockets and clearly defined areas to the city as well. And I guess because of the pace of movement, that no matter where you are, you just feel there's another cafe that's open that that I should be at, or there's another restaurant, or there's another great bar. I'm not sure if you have that sense. And do you think that there's still a great momentum here, the momentum that we've really been sort of feeling almost over the last, two decades, but certainly this past decade? Where does Berlin sit right now, Marcus?
Well, I think you are absolutely right. Obviously, Berlin is changing all the time. You see new shops, new cafes, new whatever bars going up every week. I mostly notice this whenever I go to Hamburg, for example, or Munich, where I find it looks more or less the same like last time I went, say, 1 year ago. Maybe.
Don't be rude about your neighbors.
I love Hamburg. And it's a great thing about Hamburg because it's reliable. You know the great bars and you know the good restaurants. In Berlin, this is difficult. You know, as you said, there's always a new place you want to check out, and maybe it's not that good yet because the new restaurant probably isn't that good in service.
Right. Yet.
So, I think it helps if you just stick, as the Berliners do, stick to your Kiez, as we say here, your area of town. And then you can navigate around quite okay. You can go by bike, you can walk, and it sometimes even feels like a small town.
What does that stem from? Because often we talk about, and when we look at prices to buy property here, to rent office space, the barrier for entry is incredibly low still certainly by London standards and by the standards of major global capitals or major G8 capitals in that sense. Is it that, or is it also that it's I guess one could argue it's also the most international of German cities as well? Why the sort of pace of change and this startup mentality?
Well, I think it's a trend that reinforces itself all the time. I mean, if you want to buy real estate now, it's gotten pretty expensive right now. In my neighborhood, it costs like 5,000 euros square meter, which feels expensive to me for Berlin. But still, there's so many places around town where you can just open up a shop and just try something you always wanted to try. So, and I think word gets around. So people call home to the US or wherever and say, come to Berlin. It's a great place to start a company.
Is it quite a liberal city to set up a business? I know that, of course, even when you've worked on the metrics and we look at livability in cities, and this is not a Berlin issue, it's a German-wide issue, that the closed Sundays is still a bit of a prop. Some people love it, some people don't. But just to actually go and set up a shop, is it actually quite easy to kick off a business here?
I think it is, and Berlin is trying to encourage this. They have this institution they call Berlin Partner, and they even help you set up shop and help you start a company, because obviously they know that it will create jobs, and jobs is what Berlin needs, because we have a really high rate of unemployment still in Berlin.
And is that because, I wonder if that it is a hangover to the days of the wall as well, that this was a bit of a refuge and a sense that you could have quite a bohemian lifestyle, and even then at a decent cost of living?
Yeah, life is still cheap in Berlin, and it still has an increasingly good quality of life, I think. Berlin is much greener than you would think from the outside, and it's getting more, or let's say it's getting less ugly.
Right. And if you look at the face of the city, because I guess that's the other element, it always feels in motion. It doesn't feel finished, whereas it depends on where you are in London or in New York. Those cities feel very complete, but Berlin still seems that it's a city which is being created.
Yeah, and sometimes that's a pain. I mean, whenever you think the building has come to an end, they start the next construction site. So, for example, from my apartment to the main station, it's like 10 minutes by bike. It's really close. But there's lots of construction on the way now, and you just can't get there, not even by bus.
Marcus, there was many other things we were going to talk about today, but we're out of time. I want to say a huge thank you for your correspondent role. But it's great that you're going to be a contributing editor, which means you're going to write even longer pieces, maybe not as frequently.
I hope so.
Dankeschön.
Thank you.
You are listening to Midori House from Berlin. We're back after this.
LDN TYO NYC MT.
And And in the next half hour here on Midori House, we're going to be talking to the publisher of Gestalten Books and discussing Berlin's food scene with an entrepreneur and restaurateur. But first, back over to London to Nick Kelly with the headlines.
Thanks, Tyler. Mitt Romney could take a big step towards polishing off chief rival Rick Santorum and seize command of the race for the Republican US presidential nomination today, with Ohio the biggest prize among 10 states holding contests. The Syrian president Bashar al-Assad faced growing Western anger today for preventing aid from entering a devastated district of Homs and over accusations of human rights abuses, including pictures said to show torture victims at a hospital in the city. The UN Arab League special envoy to Syria, Kofi Annan, will travel to Damascus on March the 10th for his first visit since being appointed to the post. Six world powers have accepted an Iranian offer of talks on its disputed nuclear program, the European Union's top diplomat said today, after a year's standstill that has increased fears of a slide into a new Middle East war. Benjamin Netanyahu has assured President Obama in Washington that Israel has not made any decision on attacking Iran's nuclear sites, but the Israeli Prime Minister gave no sign of backing away from possible military action. Civic leaders in Libya's eastern region of Cyrenaica have declared the creation of an autonomous council. The region is home to most of Libya's oil resources. Russia's opposition said today they feared Vladimir Putin had decided to use force to smother their protests after riot police detained hundreds of demonstrators challenging his presidential election victory. The UN Security Council reprimanded Sudan and South Sudan today for repeated cross-border clashes that were fueling tensions over oil exports and territory disputes and have become a serious threat to international peace and security. US authorities have said the top members of the Lulzsec computer hacking group have been arrested and its leader previously pleaded guilty to carrying out over a dozen cyber attacks on major companies. And flooding across three states in eastern Australia have left large swathes of farmland underwater, numerous small towns inundated with water, and forced a total of 10,000 people from their homes. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Kelly. It's just coming up to 1932 here in Berlin, 1832 in London. Well, in an industry where many publishers are turning to e-books, Berlin-based publishers Gestalten are creating beautiful and unique titles, which are conceived and created by a team of quality-conscious designers. Die Gestalten Verlag is a publisher and creative agency mostly known for their 350 books on art, architecture, design, photography, and typography. And now joining me in the studio is the company's president, Robert Clanton. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Taya, for the warm introduction.
No, not at all. Just picking up from where we left off with our Marcus Albers and the whole idea of this being something of a startup hub. And I think if you go to Barcelona and New York and Los Angeles and Tokyo, I think a lot of people think that this is a place that you can, you know, really come and kick off a business. And I'm looking at one of your titles here. Just called Introducing Visual Identities for Small Businesses. I mean, to me, this is, you know, better than the IKEA, you know, home office catalog where you sort of dream and think about, I'm going to go and start my own business. What was the inspiration behind a book like this? Because this to me seems typically, you know, Gestalten.
Thank you. I think the inspiration behind this is that what we see is a lot of people who started a career in the creative industry suddenly sort of bail out and try to run their own businesses. They are eager to have a kind of a storefront business, have clients, sell real products to real people, and maybe have an online business on the side. Mm. And so as that sort of background is in creative industry, graphic design, they want to do something special. And so they are very creative in creating their own identities, both for whatever letterheads and logos and store design and all that. And we were just happy to compile it.
Mm. I mean, you're really chronicling, this book certainly jumps all over, you know, all over Europe. And yet you also see businesses, you know, which are, you know, very much around the corner here as well.
True.
I was talking, you know, when I was asking Marcus about just, you know, the mood for starting businesses, is local government or government on a state level, you know, doing enough, you know, to encourage startups, do you think? Is the climate right in the city?
The climate is right, definitely. I think there's a lot of encouragement from the authorities to really start your business here. Mm. So it's very easy to get started and very easy to get to a certain level. It's more complicated maybe than in other cities to sort of get beyond a certain point and become national-wide known or worldwide known. That may be a little bit easier in places like New York or whatever. But for starting a business, Berlin still is ideal.
Hmm. Earlier in the program, I was talking to Ulf Poschardt from Die Welt and asking about the Germans' love of their dailies or their weekly magazines and certainly their monthly titles. It's interesting when you look at the book market in this country as well, on the retail side, pretty good numbers when you compare to the crisis that you see elsewhere. You know, still, it's a sector which has its challenges. And I'm wondering, as a publisher, do you feel you have to push the tactile nature even more? Or is it about opening up new communication channels to drive people to your books? What are the challenges and what's going right in Germany at the moment?
I think that the main challenge is trying to understand media, the way that media is sort of developing these days. If you think of a telephone book, it is a joke. Nobody would ever want to have one of those lying around. So people are happy to sort of use information in the right format. And some stuff, some information, they want materialized. They want it to be printed in very nice books on nice paper because they think that it is a kind of an expression of their personality. Mm. So they're really happy to have that and pick that up. On the other side, if you look at whatever other forms of books, they seem pretty redundant because the information is available on apps or whatever. So you really have to know what paper is good at and what doesn't really work or gets outdated too quickly.
Mm. I'll come back to where you stand on ebooks and everything else in a moment, but I would think, when you pick up a title like German Architectural Digest or any number of interior magazines, I would think that you probably still feel pretty good about your business, because I think if many readers are like me, when I look at someone's interior in Madrid or I'm spying just, wonderful spread after spread, let's say in AD, for example, of a great house in Istanbul on the Bosphorus, I'm always looking on the bookshelves. And I feel that this is something which defines personality. It's not just about the decorator that you're working with. And, will we be in a place in 10 years' time where you're only going to see a tablet device on a table? That's going to define. I mean, that's why I think that you must be in a pretty good position still. Certainly doing the types of books that you're doing as well.
I think it's like a chewing gum. It stretches to both ends. On the one side, you have the digital lens where it's all getting to be cheap and for free on the other side. But the rest of the industry is moving towards higher quality and material and even better paper and gilded edges and all that. So if you really want to buy something which is valuable for you, then you want it to be done in the right way and you're willing to spend money on it. What's going to be pretty complicated is the middle ground of publications that are somehow replaced or not so nice or soft covers or whatever. So people are not really happy to buy that as a physical edition.
I mean, do you think there's almost a latent realization on the part of a lot of media companies, not just book publishers, but I think of our contemporaries who are running, organizations which are doing news around the clock or putting out daily newspapers, etc., that there is a very strong element of definition in the same way that people focus on what luggage they're going to carry when they get on a plane, what shoes they're going to buy, that what you've defined right now is really the creation of a whole new luxury sector and the dangers that go with it as well, because not just, you say, the middle market, but you almost mean the middle classes and people from a lower socio-demographic strata will be left out.
I couldn't agree more. This is really one of the big challenges that the whole industry is facing, not just the publishing industry, but also the society in general, because to a certain extent, it will only be accessible to some people who have the money to sort of really be able to buy that, and the rest will just be left with whatever other cheap media or some whatever pretty commercial stuff. Mm. So I think there's a critical element in this.
Mm. Just before we go, I wanted to ask you, what's coming up next? What are you excited about in terms of launch? Or something that's just come out? You only get to pick two.
What's great fun is next week we have an exhibition opening called Metal Hats. There was a guy, Jörg Brüggemann. He's a very, very good, very talented young photographer. Yeah. He traveled the world to a lot of different countries like Egypt, Brazil, Malaysia, and took photos of heavy metal fans. You know, heavy metal music sort of traveled the world and sort of... So he did photos of all the fans, and we have an exhibition of his photographs in our space, and it's great fun. It's a great publication. I really like it a lot. And so that has been very, very, very nice and very challenging. And another title that has been great fun compiling was a book called Pretty Ugly, which is celebrating the new trend of ugliness and rebellion in visual design and art and all that. So, which is not really aesthetic, but to a certain extent, it's a trend, and it's great fun doing.
Robert Clanton, president of Gestalten Books here in Berlin. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You're listening to Midori House. We're back right after this.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the Global Newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House live in Berlin. It's just coming up to 1942 here in the Bundesrepublik. It's 1842 in the United Kingdom. Well, Makita is an eyewear manufacturer based here in Berlin, known internationally for its hand-assembled prescription frames and sunglasses. The company has gone from strength to strength. And joining me in studio now are Philip Huffmans and Moritz Kruger, the founders and design directors. Welcome.
Hello.
We've been carrying on a bit of a theme about running businesses here, and I wanted to maybe start by, it's incredible when you, whether you're in Hong Kong or you're in Japan, and you know, in so many markets, you see your products. And, you know, Berlin is often sort of an unlikely center, I think, also when you think about this sector, because you tend to look to maybe a Cologne, and you look to Hamburg and Munich, I think, for also big brands that go international. Is there an advantage to being Berlin-based, would you say?
I think especially for starting a business, Berlin is a very good platform due to its very low costs. And what we understood the last 8 years, what is pretty much the biggest advantage, I think, of this city is that you easily find very good employees coming from all over the world. So to grow a business, from this perspective, Berlin is definitely very good for us.
Mm. It's when you talk about talent and a magnet of talent from around the world, is that almost tricky? Because in many ways, Berlin is defined an aesthetic as well. It's a Berlin style, and is too much foreign intervention also a danger even, when you have to sort of develop frames? Or do you think that internationalism is good when you have to also keep on turning out new collections?
I would say an international influence is always good because it keeps the melting pot boiling. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think people are attracted by the city because they can feel very free, because in comparison to other big metropoles or cities, Berlin is very, very open and you have no etiquette that you have to belong to, and that's why this attraction pulls the people here, and we have an advantage of that, which is certain.
Is there a pull when you are at a major trade fair? There's an element, of course, the Germanist, and Germany, of course, stands for precision, and it stands for attention to detail, and a sense of engineering, which I think probably most people who are also investing this type of money on a pair of frames expect. But does Berlin itself also give an extra spin, do you think, and that makes it attractive to someone from Osaka or as much as someone who's buying in San Francisco?
I think it depends a bit of the audience, but I think for people in Japan, I think definitely, products which are made or handmade in Germany stands for a certain kind of quality. And as we are trying to combine this classical craftsmanship also with high technology made in Germany about surface coatings or some parts from our collections which are like coming from a very modern industry, and so this combination makes it, I would say, like a modern product, and that also stands for made in Germany, that it's kind of a permanent evolution in the design product.
It's when you touch on technology, that's a very interesting point, because when you look at eyewear, it hangs around certainly well-made eyewear, and what drives not just the trend, but I think also, again, when you have to engage optical shops around the world to purchase your products, and is it driven from the street, or are you able to, I think, keep your edge because of, as you said, new finishes and new technologies? What pushes it? Because I think we've sort of seen a bit of a retro mood over the last little stretch, and revisiting the 70s and even the early 80s. What drives the market in terms of trend for you?
I think that really most, as you describe it, that's like the way eyewear is produced has not really been changed since the last 40 years. And so if you go to a eyewear factory right now in Italy or even in Germany, so you would find exactly the same kind of technology that was there like 30, 40 years ago. So with all this retro trend, people are not really... for them, then this we're trying with our eyewear concepts and by creating new innovations and technological like hinges and so on, we're trying to transfer, like we take inspiration from maybe a look which was like from the 50s or 60s, but then trying to transfer it into a modern product by using our concepts. And I think for me, it's boring to buy something. If I want to buy something vintage, then I buy something old, and I'm not buying something which is just made.
It begs the question of anyone sitting in the studio right now. I have to ask, what's in the box? There's a lovely box sitting in the middle of the table, and I'm wondering if this is a premiere or of sorts.
Actually,
who first?
I don't know. I don't know what's in the box, honestly. Oh yes.
Okay. There's a very a very beautiful case, and you've just pulled out a rather extraordinary pair of sunglasses.
May I hand it over to you so that you can?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to read my script, but
that's just, the feel might be interesting to just touch it.
This is these are. I would say very heavy of frame across the brow. It's interesting. I'm just describing. There is a bridge, and you talk about sort of from a touch point of view. It has this somewhat. I would say it's almost like vellum. It reminds me of. Maybe there's a bit of a book and paper theme in this program, because it reminds me of a wonderful volume that you would pull from a bookshelf. How did I do?
Like what you have, somebody was saying, it looks like wood which somebody found on the Mars, and that was a nice explanation. And it's a polyamide 12, which is made by selective laser sintering. That's a production technique for the prototyping industry, but for performing prototypes, like for the automotive industry mostly. And we found this material 3 years ago, and also the way it's made was very interesting for us, because you don't have any formal restrictions in terms of shape and so on. It's extremely durable. It's 40% more lightweight than acetate, and it is thermically adjustable. So, yeah, that was the reason why we wanted to develop this more. But because, like, when we started working with this material, there was no demand for an aesthetic of the surface. So we were developing, we were creating something which then later on we named Mylon. Mylon is a patent. And it's seven different processes how to finish the surface. And then with having this material, we created a new collection for the sports fashion market, and we made a collaboration with Moncler with this material, for example. And so it should be a new segment in the world of eyewear, which is like luxury sports fashion, performance, function, and beauty of the product.
And I guess it sort of speaks to also the power of the Mittelstand in this country, how you're able to probably work with interesting suppliers and manufacturers to develop something like that. Philip Hoffmans and Moritz Kruger from Akita, we are out of time, sadly, but thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. We're in Berlin. We're back right after this.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozhalovat, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are back with Midori House here in Berlin. It is just turned 1951 here on the continent. It's 1851 back in London. Well, it's almost dinner time here, which means it's fitting that Mr. Boris Radshin is here. Some people know him as the talent entrepreneur and restaurateur behind Grill Royal, but also the King Size Bar in the city as well. I want to talk about food and drink. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me here.
Not at all. Tell me, there's, you know, so many centers across Europe are fighting for culinary supremacy. You know, Copenhagen would have most of us believe that it's the most important city for food and drink in Europe or the world, and Stockholm's trying to make its name, and, you know, and London is always incredibly hot. Berlin, where does it stand, at least within the Bundesrepublik, do you think, in terms of what happens on the bar scene, but also on the culinary stage as well?
I think the big difference was between how cities try to position themselves. So the Copenhagen, like, they are always modernistic, always going up front, try to invent something completely new. The London is very flashy about designs and things and people, and they grow very fast, and then they're gone a few weeks later. And I think Berlin is about being very close to the real feeling. And in any kind of thing, nightlife or food, we try to be very close to the original feeling.
And you say original feeling, meaning close to the street. And I don't mean that sort of in an over urban or funky way. But my sense when I come to Berlin, and if you go to, you know, nothing is too overdone, which is one of the things I like here. As you said, I think London, it is always about, you know, trying to work with, you know, one of the best architects, and you see these extraordinary prices where sometimes you feel in Berlin, you know, they've chosen the right linen and they've got the right cutlery, and there's a focus on maybe an honesty.
If you want to destroy a restaurant in advance, you can just put headsets on the people, and the restaurant will be dead in Berlin. It will not work.
Really? However,
yeah, people won't like it. So they see a headset and they think it's corporate and belongs to a larger scheme of people trying to get the money from you. And so
you mean headset as in the terms of the people, as waiters and the headsets?
Yeah, or somebody at the door.
At the maitre d' or something.
Somebody, people will run away. This is completely international, completely not Berlin.
But would you say it could be different if you went to Munich, though? Is a headset acceptable in Munich?
Well, I know somebody who was there, and they had a place where you had to order via iPad and all these things.
But that's a nightmare anywhere in the world.
Yeah, doesn't make sense at all. But I think we have in Berlin, we have lost something. We have a feeling of great loss, which is the time before the war. And so we lost all these beautiful places. We lost the tradition in restaurants. We lost the tradition in fine tailoring and all this stuff. And so people miss something, want to have it back. And this is, I think, quite an interesting motivation generation more maybe than getting something new, because the one what we have right now is not new enough anymore. This is not a great motivation, I think.
So what does that mean? Does that mean most of the talent then is homegrown? So whether it's, you know, the money that goes into a restaurant and the people who are running front of house as much as the kitchen, you know, they tend to be Berliners, or is it also at least a German or even is it becoming international magnet as well?
I feel Berliners, and they're, most of them are from all around Germany. Like I'm from Düsseldorf or Rheinland area. Mm. And then you live here for 20 years and you feel completely Berlin.
Now, I imagine, like most restaurateurs, you probably spend enough time at least looking over your shoulder, you know, whether that's across the street or across town, but also internationally as well. And I'm wondering what you're seeing and what are the trends and currents that are happening here. I mean, as you said, aside from sort of, you know, being kind of, you know, real and honest and close to the story, geographically, where are things moving in the city? But also, you know, what's happening in terms of trends, in terms of what's, you know, showing up on the plate or behind the bar?
I think the biggest trend, of course, is local, trying to use local products. But then people try now, although right now, find out that if you really live local and you are in a subtropical country like we, then you must be very, very in advance, smart what to do. Because right now you can go just eat cabbage and something a little bit more. So what you have to do is in summer you have to pickle and you do things. And this is becoming actually like a little household. Mm. Good restaurants like a household, preparing themselves in summer for the winter and everything, and getting stocking things can only get then. And this will be the future, that people really do have a household. They don't call Rangier or somebody and say, bring me the best turbot you have right now, but they prepare themselves and they make a big plan about where to be in 5 months or 3 months.
I'm often envious when I'm here because of the quite liberal licensing laws, and that
it is good. Yeah,
yeah. Is I mean, as a restaurateur, you know, how late can you stay open here? Because as you know, I mean, people talk about London being very international, but you know, the pavements do.
This is not only a federal law, but we have a special law here, which is originating in the alley, the law of the alleys, and therefore we don't have a closing hour at all in Berlin. We can do whatever we want.
Really?
Yes, and there's no amount of licenses like you have in Rome, for example. Mm. You have to buy a license from somebody, and you have to beg him to sell him you the license, please. And it's not that if you go there and you're not you've never been to prison and you show that you are able to do this, you can have a license. And then when you have a license, as long as you want. A friend of mine in London just got a license finally, and then they gave it to him up to 9:30, which is,
I mean, like, you can't run a business.
No, that's just so mean.
Is this a late city? not in terms of going out for dinner, but meaning, is there a breakfast culture? And I'm wondering if anyone who's listening around the world, whether it's, you know, Australians who might be tuning in right now, do you think that they can bring what they do on the streets of Potts Point here? We're you know, of course, you know, you don't want to maybe sort of open up you know, too many gaps to competition, but.
No, we are a light city in terms of dinner. We have dinner in Berlin for Germany very late, like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 9:30, 10. We are very good selling at 10 o'clock the tables. But we don't have a breakfast tradition in Berlin, I think.
And after the success of Grill Royal and also King Size Bar, can you tell us what's next?
Well, I just opened a new place. Paulizar, which is
tonight. Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't want to make people jealous, but aside from that, but anything coming up for summer or anything, or this is the project for now?
This is the project for now, and then we need some chill out. We're not very fast people. We do things like every 3 or 4 years because we want to be sincere about it and want to have really enjoy it. Well, it's not money driven.
We're looking forward to getting out of here in about 3 minutes' time and enjoying your space. Boris Rajan, thank you very much for joining us.
Welcome.
And we are almost out of time here in Berlin and for Midori House today. Today's show was produced by Don Trump, and it was researched by Tallulah Hoback in London. Our studio manager was Andy Schlegel here in Berlin. The Monocle Daily is back at 2200 tonight, and that will be kicking off the day in Asia and rounding up the day in North America and saying goodnight to everyone in Europe. Up next on Monocle 24, it's the new episode of Section D with our Hugo MacDonald. He's been in Helsinki. He might have a few tales of that. So stay tuned for that program. This has been Midori House, a very special broadcast from Berlin. from all of us here, we're going to say a big Auf Wiedersehen. And as I was saying earlier in the program as well, we are here covering ITB for the next 2 days, aside from, of course, hosting a little evening for all of our subscribers in the city as well. But we'll be checking in from Berlin throughout the day. Nelly Gocheva is going to be around midday for the briefing. I'm going to be, I've got the unfortunate task of being here doing the Globalist bright and early, so I'm not sure how late I'm going to be at the Polisal tonight. And also our Santiago Tarditi will be checking in later. But for now, for all of us here in Berlin, I'm Tyler Berlay. Auf Wiedersehen from here. Goodbye.